Good morning. This paper was written with Judith Mastai very much on my mind. She was always the one to sidestep predictable paradigms of museum education and art history for that matter. Her center of value and interest seemed to come effortlessly from within. Is this booming? How's that? Is that better? In this sense, she was a heavy, empowering model for those of us in her circle to behave likewise. I count myself lucky to have been in that circle and to have found support for my idiosyncratic, personal, and always feminist ways of making sense of art. I dedicate this paper to her memory. I would like to take this opportunity to also thank Griselda Pollock for introducing me to Judith and for the countless ways her work and friendship have expanded the possibilities of my work and have enriched my life. It would appear that feminism and the museum have had a spirited outing this year. In the large loan exhibition of over 82 paintings of Orazio and Artemisia Gentileschi, exhibited in Rome, New York, and soon to be in St. Louis. Again, in Goya Images of Women, which was at the Prado and is now at the National Gallery in Washington, and in the exhibition Women Who Ruled in Ann Arbor, Michigan, to name just a few of the most obvious events. On the surface, it would then appear that feminism has arrived and become a player in the museum after modernism's game. And that while these events may not fulfill my desires as a feminist viewer, and I'll tell you why in a moment, they do fulfill my needs as a feminist pedagogue. Their prima facie condition of surface and display, laying out a field of luscious objects, affords endless opportunities that let me do my work. Although I will focus on the Artemisia and Orazio Gentileschi show, because I know it best, I hope these remarks will have some bearing on the phenomenon in general. To begin, I think it's fair to say that all three exhibitions, to different degrees and in different ways, share a sense of ambivalence towards this conjunction of feminism and the museum. Both terms are intended here as signs of two seemingly antithetical series of unstable yet coherent practices and ideological positions. The latter is aligned with the traditional, that is, the invisible white upper class male, structuration of art history, of art's history as knowledge. The former has been associated with newer models of structuring all three, art, history, and knowledge, through the very visibly gendered, raced, and classed interrogator. The museum's conundrum begins, at least in principle, with a slightly different formulation of these two in its double mission. This is awful. Its double mission: to serve the official discourses of art history and its elite community of professional, and to service, in the way of education, the population. Historically, before the development of the discourses of self-reflexivity and difference, these two audiences were developed as essentially different in character. Preeminence was seated in the first of the two terms, whose value was simply traditionally reduced to make culture and the means to absorb it accessible to the masses. For various reasons, not the least of which is economic, the balance of power shifted decidedly from one audience to another, as is evidenced in the hyper-attention paid these days to attendance statistics. The two audiences were and are unproblematically accommodated by blockbuster loan exhibitions under the aegis of popular subjects, such as Impressionism, Post-Impressionism, and anything that begins with the Golden Age. A handful of famous genius names of Rembrandt and Vermeer, all of which were comfortable formulations of art history, as well as automatic insurances of large audience figures. Over the years, they have become obvious in their repetition and duplication, and convey a sense of being old, not to say old-fashioned. Concurrently, the tropes of feminism, particularly the biographically based struggle of women artists, as well as so-called images of women, have taken on a modern veneer, and found lively resonance in the spheres of popular imagination, all of which renders them ideal to give a fresh facelift to the museum in modern time. Perhaps through misunderstanding, perhaps through true conflict of interest, the ambivalence remains. The surface application of feminism to museum exhibitions has resulted in creating hybrid, contradictory, and often illegible agendas. Again, for feminist educators, this moment can be seized as an opportunity to move into the confusion and develop our own narratives, to make sense of visual images and their history with new systems of logic, all the while exposing the critical assumptions that allow their absorption into older forms of knowledge. In short, we can transform the superficial overlay of feminism by reintroducing feminist evaluations and readings in depth. From the outset, I think it's healthy, if somewhat obvious, to acknowledge that an exhibition of the work of Artemisia Gentileschi is in itself a testimony to the effect of feminism in its deeper sense, with its quest to reinstate women to the history of art. As late as 1984, the Metropolitan Museum of Art could still mount an exhibition called The Age of Caravaggio, present a multitude of artists affected by him, including Orazio, and never even mention Artemisia. In 2001, the Genius of Rome show, the exhibition which was shown in London and Rome, could not do without her. And in 2002, the justification for showing Orazio at all depends entirely upon his relationship with Artemisia, who has become a veritable media celebrity. Further, more than the mere inclusion of Artemisia for better or worse results, effort has been made on the part of the curators of the show, and even some of the reviewers, to assess and assimilate the various feminist arguments developed over the past 15 or so years. And this is already a great deal more than can be said for the Goya exhibition, where the subject category woman is treated in precisely the same way that it might have been in 1967. And the title, Images of Women, is clearly just a modern gloss. For the Gentileschi show, feminist interpretations typically aggregate around two powerful subjects favored by Artemisia. Susanna and the Elders, which you see on your right, and Judith Beheading Holofernes, which you see on your left, painted several times by her. I would not be adding much here to restate the arguments, but I must say that as an educator, their very restatement is in fact crucial in naturalizing their validity in the larger scheme of things. Nevertheless, in the highly qualified, if not pejorative terms, feminists and feminism have been framed in the exhibition and press releases, a subject taken on, by the way, by Mary Garrard in her very powerful letters of March 31st to the Washington Post, it seems necessary to insist that simple pedagogical restatement must indeed vigilantly also correct the misstatement or, conscious or not, misuse of feminist methodologies, as well as the demeaning manner they are counterposed to scholarship. As a teacher, I need to constantly draw attention to the bittersweet fact of their inclusion in the catalog and war labels, and as a sign of their incontrovertible right to be, but also as a sign of their co-option by the museum. If one of the drives of feminist scholarship has been to denaturalize the masculine narratives that are presented as so-called objective art history, its corollary drive must be to make feminist narratives seem less exceptional and personal, to render them as legitimate knowledge proposed by a community of thoughtful people. As always, the first strategy for survival is reading against the text, as labels, catalog entries, and tactics of display. How can this work? we might begin by examining some critical assumptions that render subjects like Susanna and the Elders and Judith B. Heading Holofernes such productive sites for, on the one hand, feminist interpretation, and on the other hand, those interpretations' co-option. I am reminded of the time I ran across an old undergraduate professor of mine from Queens College. That's the Queens College in New York. "What are you up to, Nanette?" he asked. "Oh, I'm working on feminism and Dutch art," I proudly answered. "Oh," he queried, "was there anything?" As he walked away, I uttered my brilliant retort of, "Huh?" His myopic view could conceive only of studying something he had historical evidence was there. It is a problem that is probably more endemic in its wider implications than we are aware. And it goes beyond the trap of simple historical positivism. In fact, there is some evidence of what Mary Garrard calls a proto-feminist movement in Artemisia's own time, represented in the publications of Lucretia Marinelli and Arcangela Tarabotti, who Artemisia may even have known in Venice. But that's not the issue. The problem extends into that area of investigation that is best encapsulated under the term images of women. This term stands for the chronologically second feminist approach that came to the fore just after the quest to retrieve women artists. Its staying power, despite continual critique, can be credited to the ease with which it facilitates the absorption of feminism into conventional art history, as in, for example, this current Goya exhibition in Washington. As Griselda Pollock has demonstrated, the critical assumptions underpinning images of women often depends on an all too facile understanding of the creative process, one that collapses visual imagery to one-dimensional good and bad pictures for equally simplistically conceived impressionable women to look at. The trap is even more seductive and dire in the case of Artemisia Gentileschi's images of Susanna and the Elders and Judith Beheading Holofernes. As rich and complex paintings, they exist in a nexus of different discursive possibilities. Among them, the, for us, reassuring possibility that they somehow, for her, gave voice to the anguish, fear, anger, and hatred engendered by the personal circumstances of her very real rape. The move is to collapse the person of Artemisia into the personage of Susanna and Judith. This is the line into the Artemisia of museum exhibitions. Whether or not the curators are willing to take responsibility for it or simply shunt it off as something that feminists say, it is the line that they repeat, and it is the line of evidence that they use to advance to make sense of Artemisia's paintings. The feminist educator in this exhibit has the opportunity to expose the biased ideology at work in this asymmetrical application of such a move. For what is good for the daughter ought to be good for the father. In an exhibition whose subtitle contains the words father and daughter, the multiple examples of Lot and his daughters within it should have set those off. If they did so, they were not heard nor heeded. With no less than four examples of the subject of Lot and his daughters on the walls of this exhibition, there is much that can be said. Three of the examples are by Orazio, one by Artemisia. Most evident among the biblical story's many narratives is incest, a subject with a much deeper social taboo than rape. This sinful act is justified in biblical account by the desire for racial preservation. Lot's wife having been turned to stone for looking back at the burning Sodom and Gomorrah, his daughters intoxicate him enough so that he will lay with them, but not need to take responsibility for doing so. Clearly a scenario filled with rich psychoanalytic potential for a father painter who often reputedly used his own daughter as a model for his female figures. In the 17th century, this subject was at the height of its popularity, which serves to explain, I suppose on one level, the multiple examples of it in the Gentileschi repertoire. Still, against this evidence and the long history of prestigious male patronage that fills pages and pages of the catalog entries on the subject, must also come some acknowledgement of the affective meaning of the repeated created fashioning of a father's erotic relationship with his daughters, and what that effect might have been on Orazio. His compositions revel in the physical intimacy created by the jumble of bodies who touch and hold one another. The configuration becomes more personally fitted in the later interpretation. Just a second here. The configuration becomes more personally fitted in the later interpretation, where the second daughter is marginalized, almost dwarfed, and removed from the group, while the other daughter, the physical proportions that make her a viable partner for her father, holds her father in her lap and strokes him. Now I'm confused. Okay. Orazio's psychological struggle is expressed, at least, in the difficulty he evidently had in working the composition through, as is witnessed by the radical changes he made in its earlier stages, which can today be seen in the painting's X-rays. The curator's psychological struggle is also in evidence, in the contradiction between seeing the painting as an expression of Orazio's desire and wanting to keep him unsullied by it. The description by Keith Christensen of the paintings reads, quote, Lot/Orazio, that's my inclusion, is a passive presence, the spent object of his daughter's schemes. In this resides the psychological fascination of a picture that is conspicuously lacking in conventional narrative action, end quote. And a bit further, he writes, quote, the psychological dimension emerges from formal juxtapositions, end quote. Whose psychological fascination? Whose psychological dimension? Psychoanalytic inquiry was never even entertained as a method with which to interrogate Orazio's imagery. Why should it be? He doesn't need it. No contrast could be more telling than Artemisia's formulation of the subject with Orazio's. One is a sensuous visual revel, the other is an austere turbid event. I hope you recognize that as the one on the right. Rather than Orazio's represented relationships between father and daughters as an intertwined physical intimacy, Artemisia's figures are arranged as three separate entities whose connections are limited to their outstretched touching arms. Rather than his languid, supine, reposing figures, her figures are seated, but their upper torsos are bolt upright. Rather than his display of fresh and supple bare limbs, her figures are demurely covered. Rather than his joyful bright colors and light-filled landscapes that seem to look to the future, her colors are darker, her landscape filled with the tumultuous destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and the image of the mother turned to salt for having defiantly looked back. Rather than the indistinct face of Lot in Orazio's renditions, Artemisia's Lot is easy to see and markedly aged. It is an understatement to say that Artemisia has a very different relationship to the subject than her father had. Interestingly, difference can also be perceived between the two curators as regards the subject. Perhaps predictably, the primary male curator, Keith Christensen, wrote the entries for Orazio, and the primary female curator, Judith Mann, wrote the entries for Artemisia. Probably more for practical reasons, they don't assume that the readers of any entry have read or know previous entries. In retelling the biblical story for Orazio's first depiction of Lot and his daughters, Christensen writes, quote, father and daughters, we are told in Genesis 19, lines 30 to 38, took refuge in a cave, and there the daughters, fearful that the human race had been extinguished and that they would find no husband with whom to bear children, got their father drunk and slept with him," end quote. Judith Mann, on the other hand, writes, quote, "Lot and his daughters flee, seeking refuge first in the town of Zoar and then in a cave. The daughters, realizing they will have no opportunity to marry, and thus to ensure that their father will have no male descendants, decide that their only hope is to ply their father with wine and seduce him," end quote. While the difference between these two may seem subtle, it is significant. For one, incest is enacted as a selfish female fear of not being able to bear children. For the other, it is enacted out of a selfless desire to provide their father with a male heir. I personally wouldn't want to judge which of these two is preferable, nor do I believe that there is anything to be had from judging which is closer to the original biblical meaning. My interest is rather to expose, in the full definition of that term developed by Mika Bao, whose company and pleasure I had to see the exhibition with, and whose insights have contributed a lot to this paper, by the way. But the full definition of that word expose, as Mika Bao developed it, how the construction of what we see and what we are directed to see is vested in layers of social and psychic practices, which are, for one, deeply gendered. Another opportunity to pursue this line of thought can be found in the multiple images of swooning, fainting figures in the exhibition. For Orazio, these take the form of Saint Francis and the angel, a subject represented in this exhibition with no less than four examples. The images show St. Francis collapsing in exhaustion and or ecstasy after having received the stigmata. The subject was popular in the post-Trinitarian period and drew attention, at least in part, due to Caravaggio's depiction of it in the painting now in the Wadsworth Athenaeum in Hartford. Is the Caravaggio now on your left, and the Orazio is on your right. Despite the very different interpretations of the subject, the connections between Orazio and Caravaggio seem irresistible to all historians. The written account of 1603, which noted that Orazio lent Caravaggio a Capuchin habit and a pair of rings, gives the connection on historical authenticity. Despite the fact that Orazio was older than Caravaggio, I would still maintain that what is at work here is art history's fabricated construct of created relationships couched as influence and based on a reenactment of the father-son relationship projected into the student-teacher project. Among the many insights that are obliterated by the dogmatic adherence to this fabrication, and one that emerges as glaringly clear in this exhibition, are those inherent in the relationship between father and daughter, which is, by contrast, an intellectually and psychologically messy affair. How much more cogent is the comparison between Orazio's multiple versions of the physically incapacitated St. Francis with Artemisia's monumental image of Esther swooning before King Ahasuerus, which is now on your left. Here, at least to me, is a point where Artemisia is sympathetic to her father's formulation, where she has a point of entry into a dialogue with her father. Perhaps this is so because Orazio and St. Francis's image speak of a sympathetic female subjectivity. The saint is portrayed in a state of submission, born of faith and trust. Neither standing nor lying, he relinquishes himself into the arms of the beautiful young angel who supports him. At first, from the front, let's go back here. At first from the front and eventually from behind. The erotic implications of this configuration had not been lost to Caravaggio scholars, who are sensitive to the homoerotic aspect of his paintings. For Orazio, the angel is at first extremely young and boyish. Let me go back here for a second, see how kind of cherub-like he is. He becomes older and more androgyne in the second and third examples, and is finally pronouncedly feminized. In the last example, which is painted in pastel colors and particularly in pink. Artemisia's Esther before Ahasuerus would seem to me at most, would seem to me a most natural comparison. Instead, the catalog makes the comparison between Artemisia and the Venetian painting of the previous century from the workshop of Veronese. To authenticate its point, it goes so far as to reproduce this example, albeit in black and white. While it is true that both dispose the feminine and masculine subjects to the left and right, respectively, I believe the similarities stop here. Indeed, the separation is much starker in Artemisia's painting, an effect that is heightened by the fact that she removed the servant boy and a seated dog from the front of Ahasuerus's elevated area, which makes the separation even more emphatic. And this is there still to be seen in the x-rays as ghosts peeking through the subsequent paint layers. There, but not there, they remind us of her insistent separation of these two parts. The composition has not pleased the curators, who find, quote, the painting lacks real compositional rigor. The beauty of the parts overwhelms the whole, end quote. In the real text, Artemisia is faulted for not being able to handle a composition of this magnitude, an observation that actually occurred to me several times while viewing some huge paintings by Orazio. Without my going into great detail about the expressive efficacy of Artemisia's visual language, let me here just point out that among the real effects of isolating the fainting Esther is to enframe her in a manner that calls up the fainting figures by her father in reference, deference, and difference, to quote Griselda Pollock's perceptive formulation. Significantly, one difference here is that the fainting subject is female. Esther faints according to, and not the original biblical account, but a Greek addition made to it that was very popular in the 17th century. She faints due to some combination of a three-day fast and fear before the angry king. According to that Greek text, as she fainted, the color drained from her face, and her head fell against the lady-in-waiting beside her, end quote. As descriptive as that text is, it is not sufficient to account for the erotic moment of Artemisia's painting where the face of one woman presses into the soft flesh of the neck of the other. Here, the deeper difference with her father, St. Francis, is exposed in her unashamed expression of tenderness and sexuality between the two women. Difference is also the motivating principle in the last of my analyses, Orazio and Artemisia's Madonna and Child, which are hung on the same wall in the current exhibition. Despite Orazio's is here on the left and Artemisia's is on the right. Despite the multifarious studies of this subject from every possible artist and art historian, from every style to every methodological point of view, its analysis is amazingly continues to be a fresh, engaging, and rewarding enterprise. Perhaps because it has been so overworked, it is the definitive subject, perhaps only to the female mood, for an artist to enter into a dialogue with the past and to stake a claim for artistic legacy. The stakes are higher still in the game between father and daughter. The precise subject of the two works is close, but significantly not identical. Both paintings depict a seated Madonna and child facing to the right in a neutral, nondescript setting. Both depict the single exposed breast given to the Christ child. One could read Orazio's painting as the Madonna breastfeeding the Christ child, or changing what Nicobal calls the focalizer, the Christ child feeding from her breast, taking the point of view of the child. Artemisia's painting, on the other hand, shows the Madonna offering her breast while the Christ child strokes her face. Tellingly, it is difficult to settle on the focalizer in Artemisia's painting. Reciprocity itself seems most at the heart of the subject. What tips the balance in Orazio's interpretation of the subject is vested in the position of the child, whose body faces outwards towards the viewer. The full front view of the child reveals the deep psychic and physical gratification he is experiencing at the breast of his mother. These are made visible by the automatic way he raises his left leg, arches his back, and clenches his little fist. It is also visualized by his deep, mesmerized gaze into his mother's face as he sucks the sweet, life-giving milk from her body. By contrast, Orazio's description of the mother is uneventful, rather mundane and perfunctory. The most common response that she elicits is that her breast is too high or in some other way unnatural, which is in itself not necessarily true. Gaze and body language are mutually exchanged in Artemisia's rendition of the subject. The reciprocity of their exchange, that again seems indeed to be its point, is facilitated by the baby's posture facing away from the viewer and into the body of its mother. The other significant consequence of this posture is that its sex as a determinant of the image is unspecified. Orazio's painting is unambiguously about male pleasure. The child's penis could not be more central to the composition, and its effect framed as it is compositionally by the Madonna's white sleeve and the white swaddling cloth, and in terms of its meaning, with the male-dominated symbiotic discourses of Christianity and creativity. Artemisia's child is unquestionably part of the same histories, but her baby is mercifully not explicitly visually sexed, allowing for those of us who yearn to see beautiful pictures of mother's love and imagine that it is for us to fantasize outside the realms of evidence. This would have been a very touching place to end this consideration of feminism in the museum's classroom, reading against the prescribed visual, written, and displayed texts. But as I was exiting the museum with my students, we ran across Irving Penn's photography exhibit, and it occurred to me that this field of opportunities that I was working and playing in was not a closed one, that it was in itself a fragment that opened up to ever greater, larger fields, and to deny that was to remain in a state of delusion, to have my head in an ivory tower while my body was being fried in hell. I apologize for the mixed metaphor. The Irving Penn show of female nudes, like a game of connect the dots, opened the field of the Metropolitan Museum to also include MoMA's Gerhard Richter show, and his exploitative photograph of 1967 entitled Studenten, to include the Jewish, and also to include the Jewish Museum's Mirroring Evil exhibition, and the photograph collages of Elke Christofek entitled Economical Love. This glut of images of women's sexual parts sent me rushing back to Artemisia, where I will indeed end this lecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Nanette, for opening this with such a rich and interesting paper. I'm going to move on to our second speaker, and then we'll take a break after that.